Hi everybody, welcome to the Willow Pod. It's Emily here and today I've got with me Skye.
Hi everyone.
And also we've got Chelsea here who works in one of our refuges here in Derbyshire. Hi Chelsea.
Hi.
So we wanted to ask you first of all,
how did you get into the domestic abuse work that you do?
So many moons ago, I started on a 100-day social work placement, and I was actually based in one of the refuges that I manage now. So I was training to be a social worker, and this was my very first kind of experience of frontline work. And I worked with a key worker of two families down in refuge and their children, worked with social care, housing, many other professionals, healthcare professionals, midwives, health visitors. And I learned so much, like so much, that I didn't really feel that I learned in my social work degree. We didn't really have much input around domestic abuse, if I'm honest, which surprised me considering that the vast majority of cases in child protection are linked to domestic abuse. And I learned such a massive amount in the 100 days that I was on placement there. So I had my second placement in foster and adoption, and when I graduated I came straight back here on a 0-hour contract, and fortunately for me they just got a new project and they were looking for people to join that new project, so I was successful in a position there. And I've been there ever since. I think that was 2011. I was first employed here. And then I just worked my way up through management, helped set up the male refuge that we've got. And currently my role is to manage our three women's refuges and our male refuge, and to support the Children Young People projects as well.
Wow.
Wow, 10 years. You must really enjoy it.
I do, yeah. Yeah, it's every day is different. It's one of those jobs where you're not bored because you think, oh, I've got an admin day today, and then your admin day just goes downhill because you're dealing with whatever is coming through the door, you know, an emergency drop-in, emergency referral, a crisis that's happening. So it keeps you on your toes.
So can you talk us through a normal day in the refuge? What would you do?
That's a really hard question because there isn't really such thing as a normal day in the refuge. Like I said, every day is different. Even managing the refuges, every day is different for me. But as a frontline worker, typically, if you have a new referral, you would admit them, you'd show them around, you'd introduce them to all the other residents. You maybe form a buddy system so that they feel that they've got somebody to go to if they've got any questions. You'd make sure that their basic needs are met. So, you know, an emergency food parcel, emergency cash payment. Do they need donations? Do they need clothes? Is their room suitable? Sometimes we get people who, you know, turn up with they're a woman and two children, but then they come with a woman and two children and a baby, and sometimes the room's not quite adequate. So, you know, it's finding a travel cot for the baby to stay in, making sure all the needs are met, making sure that people are aware that they're in the area who need to be made aware. So if they've got children under five, like a health visitor, if they've any needs such as you know, alcohol needs, if they've got mental health issues that they need to get support with urgently, then it's making sure that all those connections are made. So it's quite a busy time when they first come in, but then it slows down a little bit when they have been admitted to refuge and when they find their feet a little bit. We encourage independence, you know, we encourage them, we'll sit with them whilst they make a GP appointment. In the early days we might make that appointment for them on their behalf, and the longer that they're there we're encouraged a little bit more independence, and we'll say, you know, why don't I sit with you whilst you make that GP appointment. It's not as scary as you might think. It's a little bit intimidating sometimes. You know, we might attend that first GP appointment with them, but as it goes on, they might feel more comfortable to do those visits independently. So it's quite it's quite different, I'd say. It depends on the needs of the client, really. But we would support them with housing. We'd support them with benefits, debts, finances. If they've got a particular need, sometimes it's child contact. Sometimes they've got high level child protection concerns, and we'll work quite closely with social care and with schools. So there's a lot of multi-agency working in refuge. Our typical refuge has got, we've got 2 8-bed houses, 1 6-bed, and those are the women's ones. And then our male refuge is slightly smaller, it's a 3-bed. But all four of our properties are communal, so they do share kitchen, living room, dining room, playroom. The three women's refuges have offices based inside of them, so the staff are based in the house where the residents are living. So it means that they can come to us, whatever the need is, they can come to us and we'll be able to respond immediately, as opposed to waiting, calling your key worker and then waiting for them to have an appointment to come out and see you. So it's quite a responsive job, I'd say. You know, you might have a few appointments booked in and you might think, you know, I know what I'm going to do today, but then something might happen. Communal living is also not without its challenges. As you can imagine, you've got 8 very, very different people living there who've got different needs, and then throw children into the mix. Our 2 biggest rooms can accommodate 4 children. So you're talking of, in one house, you've got 8 women and 8 children automatically just in those 2 bedrooms. And then every other room can fit at least 1 or 2 children. So you can have, I mean, at the minute between 2 houses, we've got 18 children in at the moment.
Wow, that is a lot.
Yeah.
You often find that, is it common for your refuge to be full all the time then?
The vast majority of the time, yeah. We don't reserve spaces, like, so you can call in and say, could I have your next available space? Because we work on whatever spaces we've got on that day. So there is a database that I'm sure my colleague Jada maybe spoke to about, where we input our vacancies every day, and then people, housing, social care, other helplines will call us and say, oh, I've noticed you've got a vacancy, can I make a referral? So the spaces, they go so quickly that you can't really operate a waiting list as such. In some extreme cases, you know, if they've got a legitimate reason that they need to be in that local area, i.e. their children are in foster care and they see them 3 or 4 times a week and they need to be within that radius, if it's safe to do so, we will try and keep them as close as possible. But when you're looking at risk, you have to kind of consider the safety of not only that person but the other people living there. You know, is having a local person going to put the other residents at risk if they're followed or anything like that? So yeah, so it's a very busy job. There isn't like a typical day as such, but we go on the needs of the client. So whatever the clients need, we'll try and meet their needs as best we can. A lot of multi-agency working, like I said, dealing with the residents' needs and the children's needs as well. Each of the children, when a family comes into refuge, say we've got somebody who's got 2 children, there's an adult worker who will work with the adult and they'll do all the stuff around benefits, debt, housing, applying for homelessness. When they get their property and they've bid on their property, they can apply for furniture for them through grants. So we apply for the Derbyshire Discretionary Grant. We can apply for rent in advance. A lot of places want 1 week rent in advance, which sometimes people just don't have that money. If you're living kind of week to week off of your benefits, really. So we can apply for some funding for them. We apply for their furniture for them. We help them set up that tenancy. So gas, electric, water, making sure their housing benefit and everything is in place. And then when they do leave, they're offered up to 4 move-on visits. Yeah. So they're like visits where we help them adjust to their new community. With COVID, that has been a little bit difficult because it's primarily been over the phone. And that has been quite challenging because some people, as sad as it is to say, have never had the opportunity to run their own home. So they don't know that they need to pay things like water rates and a TV license.
Yeah.
And it's quite hard to kind of have that conversation and explain and show them where you get meter readings and where you get X amount of readings from when you're not able to go and do that home visit. So it has been quite challenging during COVID, but the refuges have remained open during COVID and the staff have remained on site during COVID, which is something that obviously we're quite proud of, because we recognise that it was much, much needed service during the pandemic.
Absolutely, you should be really proud of yourselves. I was thinking as you were talking, it obviously it's good for you because it keeps you busy, but it's so sad that all your refuges are full.
Yeah, it's one of those like double-edged sword, like you are happy that the service is being used, but you also feel sad that it needs to be used in the first place. But
absolutely.
when the children come into the refuge as well, each of the children are allocated a separate worker who, obviously, because the refuge workers for the adults specialise in everything that I've just mentioned, you know, got a wealth of knowledge around benefits and debts and housing. And then the children have a separate key worker who works closely with the adult one, but they specialise in everything for children. So schools, the school admissions, getting school uniforms, supporting them to just adjust to refuge life. They do some group sessions with the children in the refuges, so, you know, getting to know other people, other families and other children in the refuge, and then they go into the schools and do one-to-one visits with the children who are in our refuge in their schools to make sure they're settling in okay, explore their wishes and feelings, and just give them like a safe space to talk. And we keep them open for the whole length that they're open in refuge, and they're also offered move-on support as well, so that we can get them enrolled in their next school, make sure all the information and records has been passed over. So each person who comes in, adult and the child, has a key worker separately, and those two key workers work together to make sure that their needs are met holistically, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. It sounds like we need to do another podcast just on that topic.
I did also wonder, how long are the people usually in the refuge before they move into their own house?
It very, very much depends. It's kind of how long is a piece of string. So for the less complex cases, so for somebody who maybe doesn't have any alcohol, drugs, severe mental health, high level child protection, immigration, those issues, for somebody who doesn't have those issues, then it could be between 3 and 6 months, but it all depends on the local authority. The local housing offices in our area, we work predominantly with two local authorities, and we've got really good relationships with them. They treat our clients really, really well. They prioritise our clients. We've got a really well-established working relationship. So when we refer locally, it's really, really quick. We can be talking maybe 4 weeks before they get a bidding number. Then when they get a bidding number, it could be maybe another 8 weeks for them to bid on before they're offered a property. So maybe a 12-week stay. If it's outside our local authority, in major cities, some of them have got quite extensive waiting lists. And when we consider people who might need more support around cultural needs or religious needs that maybe you can't find within our area, and we're looking outside our area, it can be a little bit more complicated, because the major cities around our local area have got quite extensive waiting lists. And I think COVID did have an impact on the homelessness and the waiting list for the major cities. So if they are wanting to be rehoused outside of the local area, it can be a little bit longer, maybe 3 to 6 months. If you do have somebody that you're supporting who's got some additional complexities, like immigration, for example, if they've got no recourse to public funds, we have to deal with that issue before we can even think about getting them rehoused. So we have to think about, okay, so let's get them an application to the Home Office for indefinite leave to remain. Let's get them a national insurance number when they've got their indefinite leave to remain. Once they've done that, let's get them their benefits up and running, so they've got access to money. And then once they've got their benefits, then we can start applying for housing. So for immigration cases particularly, you could be looking between 9 months and a year where they're in there by the time you've done all of that. If you've got somebody who's got alcohol, drugs or complex mental health, we like to try and support them around that predominant issue, and then once they've got support in place and an established support network for those issues, then we will look at getting them rehoused after. We find that unless you address that issue, you're almost setting them up to fail, because you know, you want them to have the best outcome when they go into their own property, and you want them to know how to deal with if they're having a relapse or if they've got severe mental health issues. You want to know where they can go for support, and you want to make sure that support is in place.
Yeah. Crikey, there was a lot there that you talked about that I never considered. All the Home Office stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, we're aware of, they call it the toxic triangle, don't they, with drugs, alcohol and mental health issues. But that just adds so many more layers to what you're doing. It's crikey.
I like to think that the refuge workers are like a little bit like a social worker, a little bit of a housing worker, a little bit of an immigration worker.
They do
a little bit of everything, really. So,
absolutely.
So what are your hopes for your service for in the future?
I think just for them, just for us to remain, you know, obviously it's always uncertain when you work for a charity around funding and whether you're going to be able to get the funding. So I think my hope for our future service for our refugees is that we're able to have all four of our refugees remain open. We're able to have them all staffed, equipped, like, with the equivalent of two full-time staff members for each of the big houses, and a children's worker as well. So we'd like to make sure that they're fully staffed so that we can meet the needs of all the clients, and just make sure we could get the best for our clients, really, you know, for the refugees to be a nice warm environment where you can go. We'd like to make sure that they're looked after and that we've got some services available that we could, you know, make sure that there's funding to dip in and out of, to make sure that we're replacing furniture that needs to be replaced, the painting that needs to be done, and repairs that need to be kind of done, if that makes sense. So I think for my service, it's just to make sure that they are around, because of all the domestic abuse services, refugees in particular are just so needed.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, if you had a magic wand, what would you use it for? If we could get the government to do something different, what would you ask them for?
Well, that's a tough question. I think this one stems from my kind of personal beliefs, having done the social work programme. I really, really think that people should be made more aware of domestic abuse and the impact that domestic abuse has on not only the victim and the children, but also like the wider society. You know, it has a massive knock-on effect with everything that I've just mentioned: housing, drug services, alcohol services, mental health services, probation, prison, social care. It just has such a knock-on effect. And I do a lot of work with social work students around educating them around domestic abuse, and one of the things that I say is, like, domestic abuse for us is like throwing a pebble in a pond. So the pebble, yes, is the domestic abuse, and every other ripple after is the impact that it has on society. And I don't think people are aware of it, and I don't think they're aware of what a massive issue is. I mean, I can certainly say that I was not, if I'm honest, I was disappointed that I got this as a placement when I was a social work student, because I thought, oh, well, it's not going to be that busy, is it? You know, I want a juicy placement, I want a child protection placement. And I was just stunned when I got there and I realised the extent of it, and I wasn't taught anything about it. So it was a big shock for me. And I think if it was a big shock for me coming in doing a professional course like social work, it must be a big shock to other people as well. So I think if I had a magic wand, it would just be to get the message out there, teach it to the police, teach it to social work, teach it in schools, teach healthy relationships in schools, just get the message out there that domestic abuse is a big issue. It's not acceptable. And there are services out there that can help you, and for that funding to continue, really.
Yeah, well, we're trying to spread the word.
Yeah,
but we're just one little podcast. But yeah, I totally agree, it is about awareness. Even in this day and age, people still don't understand the complexity, and people are still asked, why didn't you just leave?
Yeah, 100%. And that question, unfortunately, has been, it was a question that was asked when I was a student, and it's a question that is asked over 10 years later. Yeah. Now, my Somerset accent was coming through then, wasn't it, later? So it's a question that is still around, really. And it's something that, it shouldn't be asked. Why aren't we asking why the abuse happened in the first place, and why the abuser chose to perpetrate those actions instead of why the victim didn't leave? And I think, like, I could go on and on and on about that question. Why didn't they leave? Because there's so many different things that people need to understand that are barriers to people leaving. You know, they might not know where to go. They might not know what services are available. And they might think, well, I've worked really, really hard to get a good job, a good house. Why should I leave? Because I made the mistake of being in a relationship with somebody who decided to abuse me. So it's a lot of uproot for somebody to have to kind of leave, really.
That can be our next podcast. we can entitle it, Why Didn't She Just Leave? Or Why Didn't They Just Leave? Well, it's been so lovely talking to you, Chelsea. Thank you so much. We really hope that we can speak to you again. I'd like to hear a little bit about your male refuge as well.
Yeah.
So we will be in touch, Skye and I. So yeah. Thank you for today.
And thank you so much for having me. It's been lovely.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming along.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.